to you all. We would like to begin our proceedings of this commemoration ceremony with the singing of the national anthem. We'll be led by the choir. Could we all rise to sing the national anthem? Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, comrades and friends, I feel singularly honored to have been asked to officiate at this important event commemorating the death of a very dear friend and comrade. The occasion we are commemorating today is not a happy one. Yet it is an occasion that has brought together people from various countries of this region and from countries well beyond this region because of the stature and esteem that Comrade Ruth First had earned internationally. In the first instance, as a militant of the National Liberation Movement of South Africa, as a democratic journalist of the highest order, and as a committed academic. I feel honored that among the hundreds of comrades and friends with whom she shared the frontline trenches of the struggle, it was I who was chosen to preside over the proceedings today. If the unadorned truth be told, the event we are marking today is a murder, an assassination. We are marking the 10th anniversary of a well-calculated and cold-blooded act of murder. An act of murder planned and executed not by some ruffian, an act of violence carried out not by some hot-headed delinquent. It was an act of murder planned and executed by clean-shaven gentlemen who go to church on Sunday in well-pressed suits. With the benefit of hindsight, we can today say the murder of Comrade Ruth First was amongst the first shots fired in the dirty war Pretoria has been waging to maintain and secure the bastions of white power in this country. It's true, there had been early indications that our country was moving in that direction. In 1973, there had been the murder of Abram Tiro and the murder of John Dube, both of whom were exiles in Botswana and in Zambia, respectively. There had been inside the country the assassination of Dr. Richard Turner in Natal. The use of murder as an instrument of state policy is not new in the annals of mankind. Every type of dictatorship and authoritarian regime has used this instrument since time immemorial. But there can be no denying that it became institutionalized in this country in those days of the total strategy. It is evident also that despite the image, de Klerk has been able to cultivate and project the racist regime still systematically uses murder of its opponents as an instrument of state policy. Since the 17th of August 1982, when Comrade Wilhelmst was cold-bloodedly struck down by a parcel bomb, the terms hit squads, death squads, have become all too familiar in the political discourse. And the weekly disclosures in the press and the media reveal to us the true extent of the factions and movements. In the 1980s, and these activities continue today. In the ranks of the movement, it's always been axiomatic, something we took for granted, that violence was intrinsic to the system of apartheid. The low-intensity war the regime has pursued against the democratic movement since the mid-1980s has, however, underscored that we never fully grasped the depths to which the racist regime was prepared to descend in its attempts to crush the democratic movement. The selective killing off of the activists and leaders of our movement features very prominently as part of that strategy, as do the random mass killings that culminated in Boy Patong on June the 17th. It would be an easy self-delusion to regard the mayhem which the regime has unleashed in this country since July 1990 as the work of a group of mavericks within the security establishment. Equally naive would be to characterize this as the work of some third force. The two tracks of the Klerk strategy have become clearer since 1990. The one track is that while engaging the democratic movement in negotiations, the National Party is determined to disrupt, dismember, destroy the mass movement's organizational infrastructure, and destroy it to an extent that that democratic movement can neither pose a serious electoral threat nor be able to present itself as a viable alternative center of political authority amongst the disenfranchised majority. We can now see that the fall of P.W. Botha and the ascendancy of de Klerk did not mark any fundamental change. It was rather a strategic retreat on the part of the regime to a better line of defense. The essential objectives of the Nationalist Party have remained unchanged. They were then, and they continue now to be, the preservation of the substance of minority domination while adapting its outward appearance. But it would be be a crude oversimplification for us to see de Klerk's policy merely as a study in duplicity. The fact of the matter is the National Party regime is caught on the horns of a dilemma. The one horn is that negotiation in good faith on the part of the regime must inexorably lead to the loss of power of the Nationalist Party regime. And having lost that power, it will have very little prospect of winning a parliamentary majority in the near or the intermediate future. It is the unwillingness of the regime to break that particular network that lies at the root of the violent destabilization of the democratic movement. There's no doubt, at the same time, that the block of class forces and strata represented by the National Party have come to recognize that they can no longer crush the democratic movement by brute force. That's the path they chose in the 1960s. But by the end of the last decade, it had led to the international isolation of South Africa, and it had plunged the racist state into a profound fiscal crisis. The grim prospect that faced them was a continuing and unending state of siege. In the context of economic stagnation, if not economic decline, compelled to face that reality, de Klerk chose to examine the option of negotiation. In this subcontinent, Southern Africa, two movements which enjoyed an extremely close and fraternal relationship with the ANC attempted the bold and courageous course of a radical social transformation in addition to winning political independence. That is the MPLA in Angola and Frelimo in Mozambique. Many these days find it easy to pronounce rather glibly that both these attempts failed. What is usually excluded from that equation, however, is the central role played by the Pretoria regime in fostering counter-revolution and engineering the defeat of the social transformation project in both those countries. On the one hand, as an aspect of a larger strategy of which violence is an equally important arm. And the intention is to force the National Liberation Movement and to force the disenfranchised to lower their sights and their expectations about the true meaning of freedom. The violence is intended to destroy the capacity of the poor, the oppressed, the disenfranchised to organize themselves and to sap their self-confidence. It is perhaps ironic that the pilot scheme for this strategy was in fact run right here on our doorstep in Crossroads, a community which resisted wave after wave of threats to dismember it, but finally succumbed when the regime could introduce the corrosive impact of orchestrated vigilante violence into its midst. The thousands of lives that have been lost since de Klerk succeeded P.W. Botha represent a grisly record of a highly refined counterinsurgency project which combines reform and repression, decentralized repression, much of it delegated to junior partners and to surrogates. It is at times like this that we particularly miss decisive mind of a Ruth First. Comrade Ruth First was outstanding because as a democratic militant and as a communist, the world in different ways. The point, however, is to trace it. Close quote. As a communist, she threw herself, heart and soul, into the national liberation struggle from a very early age. As an internationalist, she became one of the foremost campaigners for the independence of Namibia, both here at home and during her years in Israel. She also became deeply involved with the struggle for liberation among other African countries, especially the former Portuguese colonies, Mozambique, Angola, and Guinea-Bissau. That made the comrade whose murder we are marking here today so formidable an opponent of the racist regime. It has become the favorite pastime these days for the small-minded brave souls who unfortunately people editorial offices of many of our leading newspapers to mock and to jeer at the sort of revolutionary commitment comrade Ruth First possessed in great abundance. Despite the terrible reverses, the disappointments, that downright betrayed hopes that have become associated with the name of socialism during the century. Comrade Ruth never wavered in her commitment to socialism, both as an honorable cause and as a realizable goal. To her credit, hers was a commitment not rooted in a complacent and dissembling acceptance that everything that happened in East Berlin was wonderful, that everything that came from Moscow was gospel, that everything that came from Beijing was like incense. Hers was a truly revolutionary commitment in that her solidarity with the socialist countries was always a critical solidarity. Like the Karl Marx from whom she drew her inspiration, she firmly adhered to his favorite adage, doubt and question everything. In the world of the Cold War years, where people were compelled to take sides, this was an extremely difficult posture to assume. It required immense courage, on the one hand, to give support to those countries which had adopted socialism, while at the same time recognizing that theirs was a socialism that was deeply flawed. It was a rare toughness of mind and integrity that enabled Comrade Ruth First to keep faith with the hopes, with the dreams, with the aspirations embodied in socialism, while contending with the reality that actually existing socialism had ceased to inspire anyone, least of all the people in those countries. The Cold War years, on either side of that great geopolitical divide, did not permit of such subtle distinctions. And critical Marxists like Comrade Ruth First often have to suffer the opprobrium of both sides, because while they refused to cover up, lie, and conceal the horrors and crimes of Stalinism, they also refused adamantly to embrace the equally bloody system of late monopoly capitalism and its derivative imperialism. There are those who, like today, keeping their hands clean and unsoiled by the muck and mire of struggle, who then pronounce loftily about the partisanship of those who embrace socialism. Comrade Ruth First was often at the receiving end of such barbs. Perhaps there's no way to answer such clean-handed critics, except perhaps to recall the response made by that great German dramatist and playwright, Bertolt Brecht, who was challenged once about his decision to return to the GDR of Walter Ulbricht. He said in response to his critics, "Morally, there is not much to choose between the old, decrepit core of Western capitalism and the young, lightsome core of deformed socialism, except that with the latter, there is at least the possibility of conception. I cannot say that this is the view that Ruth first held. What I do know for a fact is that she would have been amongst the first to acknowledge and proclaim the indispensable role that the material, moral, and military assistance from the socialist countries played in the liberation struggles of our continent, not least in the struggle for South Africa itself. If now we can celebrate the independence of Angola, Zimbabwe, Namibia, it is not thanks to London, not thanks to Bonn, not thanks to Washington, not thanks to Paris. We owe that in large measure to the countries of the socialist community. The life and work of this remarkable woman, I am certain, will continue to inspire journalists, revolutionaries, and Democrats of our subcontinent for many years to come. In my view, she personified all the qualities that make for a dedicated revolutionary socialist. This evening's events are held in recognition of Ruth's first work as a democratic journalist. For decades, it was her pen and her investigative journalism that made the men in Pretoria tremble. It is indeed a fitting tribute to her that the Ruth First Memorial Trust has inaugurated this prize for journalism. It is my task also, as chair, to introduce to you our first speaker for today, the Vice Chancellor of the University of the Western Cape,
is the occasion which brings back Ruth very strongly to my memory. Then, 32 years ago, Oliver Tambo and I left this country, and we used to talk about how one day we would be back here together. And tonight is the first time in 32 years that we are. But perhaps overwhelming even these two considerations, I must tell you, I have written, I think, 13 books broadly on politics. And until tonight, I think I had almost forgotten what politics is about. It is not easy for me to talk about Ruth First. The deeper the feeling involved, the more difficult to find the right words. And hardly a week has passed since she was murdered that I have not felt this insistent sense of loss. Yet it is important precisely on this occasion, when a prize established in her name is being presented for the first time, that I should speak of her not as a symbol or a reputation, but as a person. I met her in 1955 when I returned from studying abroad with the intention of starting a magazine that I had decided to call Africa South. I'm bound to say that my initial preparations were marked mainly by the effect that people took to calling me Siegel Ronald, which I did not find very funny. I visited Johannesburg in search of contributors and was advised to get in touch with a certain journalist called Ruth First. I telephoned her and told her about my resources and my purposes in a way that doubtless suggested I was rich, self-opinionated, and scarcely qualified for what I was setting out to do. She might reasonably have put me off with some polite excuse. Instead, she invited me to her home for dinner. I can't say in Joe's presence that I found her husband uninteresting. It would be unmannerly, and besides, it would be untrue. We have formed our own close friendship over the years. Yet, as he above all will understand, it was Ruth that evening who wholly engaged me. It was her sheer style with which she did everything. I was interrogated without being doubted, measured without being belittled, and made in the process to give away much more of myself than I had ever calculated on doing. She must have found something behind all my pretensions, because she committed herself to my project as she committed herself to anything with a vast generosity of spirit. She contributed some of the best articles Africa South ever published and found other contributors whose work was invaluable. She was responsible for much of the standing the magazine came to possess. She became dear to me in a relationship that only deepened in the years of exile. If much of what I have said so far may seem to be more about me than about her, it is because she made an impact on my life that is now inseparable from what I am. I loved her, and I shall love her as long as I live. Soon after her death, 10 years ago, when friends and admirers decided to set up the Ruth First Memorial Trust, there were those, even some, I regret to say, in the ANC, who objected to this singling out of a white woman, while so many blacks had no such individual memorial to the sacrifice of their lives in the cause of a non-racial, democratic South Africa. The irony of their largely whispered criticism seems to have escaped them. The criticism itself was damaging nonetheless. I duly reported this to Oliver Tambo, who reacted, as I knew that he would, with rage that the racial issue should have been raised in such a context, and he made his reaction known where it had a rapid effect. I recount this now for two reasons. One is to employ this occasion appropriately for adding the Trust's own grateful tribute to the numerous but still inevitably inadequate tributes that Oliver Tambo has been paid for his long leadership of the liberation movement. The other is to declare yet once again that the Trust, in commemorating Ruth, commemorates the person beyond the irrelevancies of color or race, and a person composed of remarkable qualities. Paramount among these was the very passion of her commitment to liberation. This meant for her, supremely, of course, the liberation of South Africa's people from the regime of racism, for a truly democratic and therefore socialist form of society. But she had other qualities not invariably associated with this commitment: a moral consistency and an independence of judgment, along with the courage to express both. No tunnel vision of solidarity, for instance, reconciled her to the abuse of civil liberties by the Soviet government, or the military intervention against the development of democracy in Czechoslovakia. It got her into some trouble, for there were not, I recall, quite as many anti-Stalinists among her colleagues as there now seem to have been. Nor did Ruth regard liberation as a purely political issue. It necessarily involved for her gender relations as well. This was not generally considered to be a helpful attitude by male revolutionaries, who saw no contradiction in praising women for the militancy of their resistance to apartheid, but excluding them from leadership above a certain level of labor. It was bad enough that Ruth was known to be critical of such discrimination. Worse, she expressed her criticism from time to time with some sharpness. But then she could no more deny her opinions than pretend a respect for people she considered shallow or sham. It was not that she found it congenial to be unkind. On the contrary, she even developed a method of disguising her feelings. As someone with nothing to say proceeded at length, unrelentingly, mercilessly to say it, she would put on her dark glasses. It was an infallible sign that she was pulling down the blinds on her embarrassment and boredom. Sufficiently provoked, however, she would be more direct. On occasions, I have heard her cut up an opponent with the speed and economy of a food processor. If this suggests that she was intellectually arrogant, and there were certainly those who believed that she was, such could scarcely be further from the truth. She valued ideas too highly to suppose that she had all of them she needed, and that they had only to be kept like so many pots of preserve on some shelf of her mind, never to be taken down and looked at for signs of mould. In fact, I have known no one else who came to new ideas so excitedly and with such readiness to explore them for what she might discover. Not least, she was able to communicate her intellectual excitement, especially to the young, in whose concerns and reactions she was always so interested. This made her a marvelous teacher. Long after she had left the University of Durham in England, where she had taught development studies, those who had been her students spoke of her in terms not only of respect, but of gratitude and affection, because she had informed their minds less with instruction than with a shared sense of intellectual adventure in the service of real liberation. Since this last remained the measure of all that she did, she was too a marvelous researcher who pursued the implications of her findings to recognize what was wrong as well as right in the engagements she supported. In her work at the university in Maputo on the cooperative movement in an embattled Mozambique, for instance, she did not shirk from identifying the bureaucratic blight which had settled on its functioning. If I make her sound too good to be true, this is certainly not my intention. She was a richly complex person with all sorts of contradictions. She should have been so self-assured. She had so much to be self-assured about. But she was, in fact, extraordinarily shy and vulnerable. She was puritanical in her principles, but slipped helplessly from these when presented with the temptation of Italian shoes. Her passion for politics did not preclude a passion for having her hair done. Her life was devoted to momentous preoccupations, but she delighted in gossip. During our holidays together, I don't know whether he's admitting to it now, but during our holidays together, while Joe and I, on rare occasions, played cards for money, a pursuit of which she distinctly disapproved, she and Susan, my wife, would discuss with obvious enjoyment people about whom they could not either of them have cared less. Neither activity advanced the revolution, but then nor did a holiday, and she enjoyed it all the same. She had such a capacity for enjoyment. She did not laugh easily, but her laughter was wonderful. That remarkable book that she wrote about her detention in solitary confinement. It has anguish in abundance, but also a certain self-mockery that is rare in the literature of imprisonment. It is difficult to make the transition from journalism to writing books. In 25 years of responsibility for the Penguin African Library, I commissioned books from journalists of considerable distinction who were so accustomed to composing within the scope of a few short paragraphs that they lost themselves completely between passages in the same chapter. Editing their work was an exacting and protracted process. In the various books which Ruth wrote and with which I was connected, I encountered no such difficulties. She knew that a new skill was not an old one that merely needed a new overcoat, but one that had to be learned, and she therefore applied herself to learning it. She was a serious writer, as she was a serious journalist, a serious teacher, a serious researcher, a serious revolutionary, not least because she never took herself too seriously. I hope that my remarks on the difficulty of making the transition from journalism to writing books do not imply any belittlement of journalism itself. On the contrary, I and my fellow trustees can have paid no higher tribute to its value than to have chosen journalism as the medium for the prize to commemorate Ruth. Insofar as it does its proper job, it requires moral commitment and courage, and of course, the more of both, the more that those in power are determined to thwart its activities in concealing their own. Without the dedication and diligence and daring of particular journalists, the world would not know as much as it does about that terrorism conducted by agents of the South African state to which Ruth herself was dated. Nor, of course, is the value of such journalism important only historical. Who can doubt its value now, while those who claim to have crossed the Rubicon are still in Moot River, and at birth, unsure about which of the boats to reach. But even when South Africa becomes at last a non-racial democracy, as it must, even then, journalism, inquisitive, critical, irritatingly persistent, sometimes doubtless irresponsible, but above all must continue so as to ensure that this non-racial democracy does not turn into something else. In January 1918, the Bolsheviks in revolutionary Russia put an end to the Constituent Assembly controlled by their opponents. The great revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg, writing from her German prison cell, issued a warning that was to prove all too prevalent. Freedom for supporters of the government only, for the members of one party only, no matter how big its membership may be, is no freedom at all. Freedom is always freedom for the man who thinks differently. This contempt does not spring from a fanatical love of abstract justice, but from the fact that everything which is enlightening, healthy, and purifying in political freedom derives from its independent character and from the fact that freedom loses all its virtues when it becomes a privilege. The suppression of political life throughout the country must gradually cause the vitality of the Soviets themselves to decline. Without general elections, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and freedom of speech, life in every public institution slows down, becomes a caricature of itself, and bureaucracy rises as the only deciding factor. I believe that in encouraging committed and courageous journalism, the Ruth First Prize will represent and promote the essential objective of the Ruth First Memorial Trust, to commemorate someone who gave so much to humanity, as well as so much joy and beauty and love to the lives of those who were fortunate enough to have known her.
You know, we trained our journalists to a very great extent in the Eastern countries because that's where the facilities were provided. The Western countries did not want to touch us. They regarded us as a propaganda group, and so they didn't want to have anything to do with us. We were propagandists. It's only recent that they are coming closer and we're training. So we've trained people at the Zimbabwe or at the Harare Polytech. We've trained people, we have people who have 2-year diploma courses from the Harare Polytech. We've trained people in Tanzania. There is, I think, an Institute of Mass Communication in Tanzania.
I must say that, you know, Don,
we used the transmitters of the host countries. We did not pay for that. We had access to their wires. We did not pay for that. We had access to their production facilities. We did not pay for that, right? And we were also not paying this ANC member. We were also, so the cost of production were very, very minimal. All you had to do was to see to it that the guys are eating and smoking. If they are smoking, you'd have the radio on the air, okay? But you then had, as we developed, right? And as we developed and as we were becoming more experienced in radio production, we realized that we want to diversify. We realized that we want to make our programs even more interesting, right? But now, come the problem that if you are producing the production facilities of the host station, then you are allocated a certain amount of time. You are allocated 1 hour in the studio, within which you are supposed to produce the program, right? But beyond that, you don't have any time or access to the studio, and therefore you can't make programs that are diversified, and you can't experiment and try and see. And then it became necessary that we should have our own studio equipment, you see? And that was when now we started making approaches to international organizations. And fortunately, this group in Holland emerged, that is Home Group for Radio Freedom. Now, the beginnings of that were discussions between the guy who was the former director of Radio Freedom, that was Victor Njivankondo, actually. So he had discussions with them, and then this organization was formed, and then thereafter I took over from him, and there has been that those relations since that time. And they are the ones who have brought us the equipment that we have now.
Yeah, I see. But just how are you doing? Is your ear getting sore from plastic things in your ear?
Yeah.
Just a few more questions.
Yeah.
One is to do with content. What was a typical broadcast? What was the format of a typical broadcast?
Mm-hmm.
How long was it? And, mm-hmm. Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Our broadcast consisted of, the format kind of varied, okay, but it was the first, depending on the time that we had. Let me say, a typical broadcast would be, let's say 30 minutes broadcast would consist of news for about 10 minutes, and it would consist of a commentary on the most current event. And then it would then consist of about a form of magazine program or current affairs, wherein certain aspects of events or follow up on events that have taken place, let's say such as forced removals maybe, or anything of like that. And that would take, say, about another 10 minutes, and then the other 5 minutes remaining would be taken up by music. And then on certain days, we would play more music, really, rather than any analysis,